Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. A president who attacks elites, hates the media, puts out charges of election fraud, and faces allegations of having colluded with a foreign government. We are not describing President Donald Trump. We are describing President Richard Nixon, who did call the press, quote, lousy, dirty, cowardly bastards, claimed a connection with the forgotten man of America, and opened up a back channel to the president of South Vietnam during the Vietnam War. Nixon also claimed to be the law and order candidate in 1968 when he accepted the Republican nomination for the presidency.
To those who say that law and order is the code word for racism, there and here is a reply. Our goal is justice, justice for every American. If we are to have respect for law in America, we must have laws that deserve respect.
Well, that is a theme that President Donald Trump explicitly echoed. Here he is in July at the Republican National Convention.
In this race for the White House, I am the law and order candidate.
Well, the lessons and legacy that we can draw from Richard Nixon is the subject of a new fantastic biography of the late president. It's called Richard Nixon, The Life. It's by John A. Farrell, and he joins us now in the studio. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Hey, it's great to be back.
A lot of biographies have been written about President Nixon. Why do you decide to take on this life now?
There was a new audience, and there was a fire hydrant worth of new material. It's kind of hard for we baby boomers to deal with, but two-thirds of the American population were either not born or not living in the United States when Richard Nixon left office. And the millennials now are the single biggest generation, and they know Nixon only as a caricature on The Simpsons or the bad guy in the X-Men's movie. So I really wanted to reach out to them and give them one volume that incorporates all the new material that's come out in the last 20 years. That they can go to if they have a little bit more interest in the real guy.
Okay, so I want to get to some of the amazing new details that you uncover in the book. But before we do, I mean, we more than intimated that people are talking about Nixon now also vis-a-vis President Donald Trump. I mean, is that a fair comparison to make to our current president?
Somebody said the other day that we've had marches in the streets, allegations of eavesdropping, break-ins at the DNC. It's like we have the Nixon administration on speed dial because it took Nixon 2.5 years to go from Watergate to resignation, and we've had all this in only 6 weeks with Donald Trump. Personally, aside from a certain grandiosity, which is evident on Nixon's tapes and Trump's tweets, they're very different men. But there are a number of coincidences in their administrations is amazing. And I think also they both have a political way of trying to tap on people's grievances, on the dark side of people, on their fears, racial fears or economic fears or fears about class. And I think that pretty much sums up their similarities and differences.
But different men? I mean, very different men? How? Tell me more about how they're different.
Very different men. Nixon came from the California outback. The pictures of where he grew up looked like Oklahoma in the middle of the Dust Bowl. And he had an awful, abusive father, and he had a mother who famously would retreat to her closet to pray and, as Nixon once said, never told me that she loved me in my life. So he always had this chip on his shoulder, and then all of a sudden in his childhood, his younger brother dies in a week, and then his older brother gets tuberculosis and dies over 6 years, wasting the family's fortune. Nixon can't go to Ivy League schools. He has to go to Little Whittier College, and he always carries this feeling that the world is cheating him, that that his enemies are out there, out to get him. Donald Trump, born of a wealthy man, sent off to military school at the age of 12, which is not exactly a great childhood, I don't imagine. But I don't see a great deal of comparisons between the two men in their upbringing.
Interesting. Okay. I might want to circle back to that
in a minute.
But let's get right to one of the things.
I'm all for pop psychology.
But I want to get to one of the things which that you uncover in the book, which is just, I mean, it's stunning. Nobody really knew, I guess, about Nixon before you published it. And in order to introduce it, I first want to just play a little tape. This is from 1969. This is November 1969, when President Richard Nixon is giving a speech on the Vietnam War And he advocated for troop reductions, but a continuation of fighting. So here's President Nixon.
Let historians not record that when America was the most powerful nation in the world, we passed on the other side of the road and allowed the last hopes for peace and freedom of millions of people to be suffocated by the forces of totalitarianism. And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority of my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
That silent majority speech. But the thing you uncovered is what Nixon did the year before in 1968.
It's a remarkable piece of the puzzle I was able to chance upon in my research. It had always been rumored that Nixon had approached the Nixon campaign had approached the South Vietnamese in October 68 and tried to scuttle Lyndon Johnson's peace initiative by telling them that if they just held on a little bit longer, they would get a better deal when Nixon took office. And indeed, what I found was notes that of a conversation between Nixon barking orders to his chief of staff, H.R. Bob Haldeman, telling them that we got to get work on the South Vietnamese, tell them to drag their feet. We're going to monkey wrench these talks. So as I said, it had long been rumored that this happened. And in fact, Lyndon Johnson had been tapping the phones of the South Vietnamese embassy and had proof that it was happened, but we never could put the words actually in Nixon's mouth, and that was able to do in the book.
This is stunning.
Well, it's for a biographer, it's amazing because it really shows the moral character of the man, that he was willing to put so many lives at stake for this expedient political reason. And you can't say what would have happened if he hadn't done this, that there would have been peace. You can't make that decision. But we do know that there were so many lives at stake. 2 million Cambodians, 1 million South Vietnamese boat people, and 20,000 more Americans died in Nixon's first term.
I mean, does that not qualify as treason? am I going too far in saying that? Like he said he's going to scuttle peace talks.
In this conversation that we're having right now about Russiagate and Trump, you will hear something called the Logan Act popped up from time to time. And the Logan Act is this very obscure a law that was passed by the founding fathers, actually. And it says that Americans are not supposed to interfere in the diplomacy of the country with their own private diplomacy. And obviously, that's what Nixon did. And it's possible that somebody on the Trump team did that as well, interceding with the Russians last fall.
I mean, H.R. Haldeman, who you mentioned, has said don't ever lose sight of Vietnam as the overriding factor in Nixon's first term.
Yeah, one of the things that I was able to use that other biographers have not been able to use is all the tapes have been coming out. And there's one particularly ugly, chilling tape where John Connolly, who was his Treasury Secretary, and Haldeman are talking about the bombing of North Vietnam. And John Connolly says, you know, we really haven't put terror in the hearts of the civilians yet. You've been worrying too much about slop over. And Haldeman says, yeah, what difference is it? What, you know, why the bodies are there or how many people you kill? And Nixon says, no slop over. And they say, yeah, right, it's no slop over. And slop over was the euphemism for dead civilians.
Well, I mean, we could spend our whole time just talking about Vietnam and Nixon. But there are so many other fascinating aspects about his presidency and about his approach to power, right? Nixon famously hated the press, right? He may not have ever, I mean, he didn't have Twitter, but but he, I don't think he actually ever, did he ever utter his disdain for the press as President Trump has had?
Almost word for word. There's a famous quote from Nixon on the tapes where he says, Henry, write this down. The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy.
But he said that privately, though.
He said that privately. Yeah. The tapes and the tweets to me are like, they're both glimpses into presidential ids. And so that's the comparison that I like to make. But it's true. Nixon was, he would go to a press conference towards the end of his term and actually say, you know, don't think that you people out there have gotten me angry, because in order to be angry, you have to respect the person who's going to get you angry. So he was pretty icy with the press, but he never went as far as to try to convince the American people that the press is the enemy of the American people.
Interesting. But you also write that he had this canny understanding of how to circumvent the media, or the press, I should say, because, I mean, you write that when he was running as Eisenhower's vice president, that Nixon found that he could outflank the press and appeal to viewers directly through television.
There was a scandalous flap at the beginning of his run as vice president in 1952. And everybody knows it as the famous Checkers speech, because he used his little dog Checkers as this heart-tugging feature of the speech. He was accused of having a slush fund used for political purposes. The only way to get out of it was to go on national television, which was an unheard of thing at this time. And it probably is the single most effective use of television in American in politics. And now that the television has been somewhat degraded by the internet, it probably will always remain so. It's a magnificent. Basically, he resuscitated himself. He breathed new life into his own mouth.
You know, we are, I think, rightfully spending time on many of the highly controversial aspects of President Nixon's tenure in the White House. But I mean, you also do write about some of his accomplishments, right? Like that he signed into law increases for Social Security, a 20% jump under Nixon, more money for education. He declared war on cancer, asked Congress to double arts funding. Also, maybe people don't realize this, but he had a significant environmental legacy as well. The National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Air Act. He established, you know, other environmental major landmarks in the United States. So these aren't things that we usually associate with Nixon as a president.
No. The major environmental groups were polled several years back about who was the greatest green president, and they came in with Teddy Roosevelt first and Nixon second. He established the EPA, and it's sort of ironic to see this fellow who's president now, who says to be an admirer of president, dismantling the environmental protection. But the phrase that I use continually in the book is "and yet," because for almost everything despicable at Nixon, you can find something that's laudatory as well. And he invented, or his administration invented, affirmative action. And his administration was the biggest desegregator of Southern schools. And yet, he was also the creator of the Southern strategy that gave the South, through a thinly disguised racism, over to the Republican Party. So a very controversial character. It was a lot of fun making my way through those different alleyways of his mind.
Well, I want to play one more piece of tape, because regardless of President Nixon's accomplishments, I think there's pretty much one moment which in the popular mind of the United States defines him.
People have got to know whether or not their president's a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
That came after a particularly awkward moment. And Nixon actually established sort of the precedent of presidents showing their income tax returns, which Donald Trump has now dashed. But it was turned out that Nixon had taken a $400,000 tax break on his vice presidential papers that had been backdated by an aide, and he had to answer questions about that. You're right. And yet, his final closing speech before he left the White House to get on the helicopter to go away, where he talks about never hate people, because once you hate them, then they've won and you destroy yourself. It's just a wonderful, moving piece of Americana as well. So very complex guy. He doesn't fit easily into today's left and right. He sort of floats all by himself like an asteroid in space. And the Democrats will never forgive him. And the right has never adopted him since Reagan.
So let me ask you, I mean, of course, there's also Watergate, and that another famous phrase, cover-up is worse than the crime.
Yep.
And I mean, you write about how people talk about Nixon collaborated in his own demise because of Watergate, but we've just got a minute here. I've got to ask you, how much does how Americans' attitudes about the presidency were transformed by Richard Nixon inform how we view all the tumult going on with the Trump presidency right now?
Absolutely. Nixon's downfall and the government investigations that followed, the Church Committee, showed a tremendous amount of wrongdoing by Americans' presidents. And this great faith that they had put in the presidency during the Cold War sort of frittered away. I would say that we're returning to that right now. I don't know what the Trump people have done, but they're acting like they have something that they want to cover up, just like Nixon.
Well, the new biography is Richard Nixon, A Life. It's by John A. Farrell. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
Glad to be here.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.